Hello and welcome to the winter issue of the new quarterly Rotary magazine. I'm Dave King, managing editor of the magazine. So yes, we've now gone quarterly, but we've got even more articles for you to listen to and some new features too, including a Rotary Readers Book Club and the entertaining columnist Jeff Mackey. It's all part of a fresh package of Rotary material which is being produced that includes this audio magazine, the print issue of Rotary magazine, the Rotary podcast, and from February, a new monthly digital magazine called Rotary Digital. Just this week, I recorded the first Rotary podcast with co-presenter Phil Dyer, where among our guests were Rotary International President Gordon McAnally and his wife Heather. So that's a treat for you to look out for, which is available on traditional streaming platforms right now. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy this first Rotary audio magazine of 2024. So, here we are, a new quarterly issue of Rotary magazine. Did you miss us? Yes, we're back after the last issue in October, which had a special emphasis on membership, which prompted a lot of positive feedback. In November, a weekend conference was held at the University of Warwick to promote the new North Star project, which aims to boost Rotary membership in Great Britain and Ireland to 60,000 in 5 years' time. It's an ambitious project, supported with Rotary International funding, which will undoubtedly leave the curmudgeons grizzling into their glass half-empty pints of bitter, but the plan has to succeed. Rotary Magazine is part of that vision, a tool for membership growth. While its accent remains as a membership magazine, it has always carried an outward focus, a publication which presents content that is interesting to those outside of Rotary, telling our story and making you think. For this first quarterly edition, we have upped the ante with more pages and more stories than ever before. We've moved the deck around a little with new features such as The Big Issue, debating key issues of our time. This quarter, it's artificial intelligence, not artificial insemination, as Cliff Richard accidentally described AI during a recent BBC interview. There's a new Rotary book club called the Rotary Readers, which I hope you will get involved with. It's run by Kent Rotarian Becky Turner. And I'm also delighted that the very funny Jeff Mackey has joined the team to pen his final word column. But Rotary Magazine is more than just the print edition. Starting next month in February, we will be publishing Rotary Digital, a monthly digital magazine which you will receive via email, carrying the latest news and more new and exciting features every month. Coming soon, I will be co-hosting with Phil Dyer the Rotary podcast on a monthly basis, which will feature some top guests from inside and outside the Rotary world. Then there is Rotary Audio, which carries a recording of selected Rotary magazine articles. I spoke at a district council meeting recently where I was flattered when a Rotarian said she enjoyed hearing my voice in the shower as she listened to Rotary Audio. I'll be careful to the next time that I pass the soap. All of these products are an impressive portfolio of dynamic medium forums which serve as a public-facing storytelling. They are a driver towards promoting Rotary to a wider audience, to those who know something about what we do but want to know more. But it is important you share them too. With the magazine, share it among friends and business colleagues. On digital, share the stories via email or social media. Show the impact which Rotary has, not just locally, but globally. This issue is packed with stories from across the British Isles, showcasing Rotary as people of action. It serves to inform, challenge, and entertain. Enjoy the magazine, get involved, and I would love your feedback. You can email me at editor@rotarygbi.org. That's editor@rotarygbi.org.
If something is not impossible, then there must be a way to do it. Rotarian Sir Nicholas Winton was a war hero who is now being celebrated in a film starring Sir Anthony Hopkins. Story by Dave King. The headline you just heard are the words of Sir Nicholas Nicky Winton, an amazing man who saved hundreds of lives during World War II and who was also a Rotarian. Nicky is also the subject of the film One Life, which was released in UK cinemas in January, starring Sir Anthony Hopkins and Helena Bonham Carter. One Life tells the true story of the young London broker who, in the months leading up to World War II, rescued 669 children from the Nazis. Indeed, in a pivotal scene, Sir Anthony, who plays Nicky, is pictured at the BBC studios where details of his heroic work were broadcast for the first time. He is pictured on screen wearing a Rotary tie and pin as a proud member of Maidenhead Rotary Club in Berkshire. Nicky died in 2015, aged 106. In December 1938, Nicky visited Prague. There he found families who had fled Germany and Austria, who were living in desperate conditions with little or no shelter and food and under threat of Nazi invasion. He realised it was a race against time. How many children could he and the team rescue before the borders closed? The film fast forwards 50 years later to that BBC studio. It is 1988 and Nicky is haunted by the fate of the children he was unable to bring to safety in England, blaming himself for not doing more. It is then that the BBC television show That's Life surprises him by introducing some of the surviving children, now adults, and only then does he come to terms with the guilt and grief he had carried for five decades. Producers Emile Sherman and Ian Canning first discussed Nicholas Winton's story when they co-founded Seesaw Films 15 years ago, having come across the That's Life clip. Emile Sherman says, "We knew the first step was to meet Nicky, who we could tell from the television clip was going to be a very humble man." Ian Canning continues, "We were very lucky to have had the opportunity to meet Nicky before he passed away. He was the most modest, generous human being who felt the film should not glorify him, but celebrate how the most ordinary of people can make a huge impact." With the blessing of Nicky's daughter Barbara Winton, Seesaw approached screenwriter Lucinda Coxon to adapt Barbara's book If It's Not Impossible. Collaborating with Barbara, who sadly died in 2022 during the making of the film, the screenwriting team gained access to Nicky's archives and letters, as well as her book about her father. Barbara was a familiar face at Rotary District conferences, who wrote an article in Rotary magazine in 2019 which told her father's story. www.rotarygbi.org/magazine/February-March-2019. "My father had a thick skin to get his projects done, and it worked," recalled Barbara in the article. "In terms of this project, my father felt he had failed. They had 5,000 names on this list and only 669 were saved. But 50 years later, when the story came out and he met some of his children, we discovered there were about 7,000 people alive because of what he had achieved." Seesaw Films producer Joanna Laurie admits the main challenge of developing the film was doing the thing which Nicky found most difficult, singling himself out. She explains, "He really didn't see himself as a hero, so our challenge was telling this extraordinary story while honouring his humility. The title of this film, One Life, could mean different things to different people, but I think the movie asks us all to reflect, as Nicky did, about our choices as individuals and as a community." Director James Hawes says this attitude was typical of the generations who faced the inhumanity of war. "We have to put ourselves in the minds of that generation. You didn't speak about the war. I'm sure many people knew grandparents and great-grandparents who have memories from the war, and they don't talk about it because it was too awful." Barbara Winton's book was also an essential resource for the cast. Explaining how she got a sense of Babby, Nicky's mother and Barbara's grandmother, Helena Bonham Carter explains, "Barbara was named after Babby. I was very lucky to speak to Barbara, to have her perspective as a granddaughter as well, but Babby was also in her book." Johnny Flynn, in his role of the young Nicky Winton, adds, "Barbara's book was an essential piece of research for me, along with several other books. The film itself bridges two time periods, 1938 and 1988. One of the elements the screenplay needed to address was Nicky's own family history and how it informed him and his choices. Nick Drake, who wrote the screenplay with Lucinda Coxon, notes, "Nicky's Jewish ancestry meant he was alert to what it meant to be an émigré from the rise of Nazism in Europe. He was ashamed by the Allies' betrayal of the Czech people in the Munich Agreement. Nicky saw the consequences of that agreement in human terms and these appalling camps where refugees from Germany, Austria and the Sudetenland were living in intolerable conditions. He was motivated by the reality he saw in front of him and decided to do something about it." In distilling the war-era story, Sir Anthony Hopkins, who plays the older Nicholas Winton, says, It's about several people, not just one man, saving the lives of children who are about to be consumed into the gas chambers and furnaces of Auschwitz, Treblinka and Belsen. It was Barbara Winton's wish that Sir Anthony Hopkins, the winner of 6 Academy Awards, should play her father. Producer Ian Canning reveals, when Barbara read the first draft of the script, she called us to say that Anthony Hopkins would be perfect for the role, which of course we agreed with, but left us with a challenge because it was beyond our wildest dreams that Anthony Hopkins would read the script and want to play Nicky. But incredibly he did, and it was magical for all of us to know we had an extraordinary actor playing a man who was such an inspirational humanitarian. The film was shot in Prague and England, working across two time periods and working with two crews in two languages. It was important to shoot the film in Prague using the authentic Prague locations, even filming on the same station platform from where the children said goodbye to their families and departed for England more than 80 years ago. A bronze statue of Nicky with two small children and a suitcase marks the historical spot at the end of the same platform. It is estimated that there are about 7,000 people alive today because of the Prague rescue. Describing the challenges Nicky and the team faced to bring the children safely to the UK and find host families, director James Hawes explains, "There was a belief in the UK they weren't at risk. A lot of people saying, it's fine, there's no issue. They're in Prague, they're not in Austria or Germany." Another challenge was British bureaucracy and xenophobia. The newspapers and politicians saying, "We're a small, crowded island. There's no place for more people here." Nicky had to fight that prejudice, raising the public consciousness, writing articles way before the internet or broadcast news, where he had to somehow get the message out there through the newspapers, word of mouth, institutions, letters, so enough people would support him. The tragedy of the final train, the ninth train to leave Prague in September 1939, was the pain which Nicky could not speak about when 251 children were loaded onto the train at Prague station, ready to leave for England. But that was the very day war was declared and the borders were closed. The Nazis pulled the children off the train. As far as is known, all but four of those children died in the concentration camps. For the emotional That's Life scene, producers invited Nicky's children and their relatives to be part of the film as supporting artists, with Sir Anthony Hopkins only told of their identity on the day of the shoot. Anthony Hopkins recalls, "It was like a kick in the chest when all the descendants came in. It was hard to try not to be sentimental, but it was very moving." Nicky was a conduit to the children's past, most of whom had lost their parents. Director James Hawes explains, "He was a lightning rod back to the roots of who they were." At that moment in the film, Esther Ranson says, "Anybody who owes their life to Nicky Winton, please stand up." And our supporting artists, the relatives, do stand up because they also owe their lives to that man. Those people would not exist but for him. There was not a dry eye on the set floor. As for Sir Anthony Hopkins, the crew said he revelled in the production, loving the challenge of telling such an amazing story. He adds, "I only hope this will send a message lest we forget, because we forget so quickly." Search One Life Film to watch the trailer. One Voice. Gordon McInally, Rotary International President 2023-24. Light the path out of dark days. In difficult times like these, it's impossible to avoid feeling heartbroken over the devastation and loss of life caused by war and destruction. Rotary always stands against harming and displacing civilian populations and using armed aggression instead of pursuing peaceful solutions. We advocate for the observance and respect of international law. We believe in strong action to defend and promote peace, even in the darkest of times. But we also take our position as an international, non-political, non-religious organisation seriously. To respect the global perspectives and experiences of our members and to work most effectively in our peace-building efforts, we do not choose sides in conflicts. Rotary is made up of 1.4 million people in communities all over the globe who are united in our commitment to building a peaceful world. We strive to ensure that our words and actions prioritise the health and safety of our global membership and the communities where we live and serve. Our members seek to offer humanitarian assistance to those affected by conflict, and our global reach requires that we promote peace building and conflict prevention with cross-cultural, cross-border connections and friendship through Rotary. For decades, Rotary has harnessed these connections to carry out service projects, support peace fellowships and scholarships, and establish programs like Rotary Peace Centres to help build lasting peace. Our members also take action to promote positive peace, addressing the underlying causes of conflict, including poverty, discrimination, ethnic tension, lack of access to education, and unequal distribution of resources. Rotary members who wish to wage peace can use district grants and Rotary Foundation global grants to support projects with other Rotary members that help refugees and displaced people, provide medical support and more worldwide. Members can also work with or join peace-focused Rotary action groups, friendship exchanges, fellowships and inter-country committees. And district-designated funds or district cash can support our peace-building and conflict prevention efforts. Members and non-members alike can learn more about peace-building through the Rotary Positive Peace Academy, a free online training course available to anyone with an internet connection. You can find it at positivepeace.academy/rotary. There is no denying that incidents of violence and atrocities being perpetuated around the world seem to be escalating. Global peace is fragile and the stakes are getting higher. Still, we know that it is possible to bring all people together to work towards a shared goal. Rotary members do so every day in every part of the world. May our ability to unify in common purpose be a spark that helps light the path out of these dark days. Together, let's create hope in the world. Find out more. positivepeace.academy/rotary. How Rotary Helped the Kinder Transport Rescue, story by Mike Levy. On December the 2nd, 1938, 200 young people descended a ship's gangplank in the Essex port of Harwich. They came from Germany without their parents, siblings, family, friends. They came alone. These 200 were the vanguard of one of the largest acts of rescue in the Holocaust era. They were Jewish children from orphanages and homes that had been torched, battered or smashed by Nazi thugs on November the 9th and 10th, 1938, the so-called Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. The children had witnessed SS and Hitler Youth beating up their parents, wrecking their homes and businesses, arresting men and carting them off to be brutalized in concentration camps. It was after this terrible night that parents in Germany decided to send their children to safety. The children had no one in Britain to look after them. Homes and support had to be found. Their arrival was entirely in the hands of volunteers, as the British government took no part in their rescue from persecution. Enter an army of British helpers, among whom were Rotarians. The children who arrived on that sunny December day had come on a train that left Germany the day before, travelled across the border into the Netherlands, onto the Hook of Holland and the night ferry to Harwich. This was the preferred route of most of the 10,000 children who came to Britain on the Kinder transport. The last such transport arrived in Harwich on September the 2nd, 1939, one day before war was declared. Then, all borders were closed, the fate sealed for the Jewish children and their families, left at the mercy of the murderous Nazi state. The nerve centre of this massive rescue operation was at Bloomsbury House in central London. Here, committees were hurriedly set up by Jewish, Quaker, Church of England, Methodist and other relief bodies. The Rotarians were an astoundingly active organisation who rolled up their sleeves to provide assistance to these benighted children. Among these were Alfred Roberts, whose daughter Margaret, later Thatcher, became Prime Minister. Another was Frederick Attenborough, father of the naturalist David. In each case, they not only drew on their Rotarian networks for support, but also went the extra mile in providing a home for German Jewish refugee children. The task was enormous, to find homes for the 10,000 youngsters. Though formal research on the role of the Rotarian in the Kinder transport rescue has not been done, clues to the help given can be found in newspaper archives and sometimes in the rare existing records of the refugee committees. The Worthing Herald for January the 6th, 1939, reported that Worthing Rotary Club had decided to adopt two refugee children from Germany and an adult from Czechoslovakia who was forced to flee his country. In practice, this meant Rotarians providing financial support for the children, a necessary condition of the visa waiver scheme, and foster homes in Worthing. The club's president, Mr. Linwood, hoped that this example would be copied by other clubs who were part of Rotary International of the British Isles. It was, he added, a way for Rotarians in Worthing to truly live up to the ideals of the club. The way the Rotarians got together to help these children is exemplified in the story of Edith Mühlbauer. She was a Jewish youngster from Nazi-controlled Vienna, aged around 16 or 17, who on January the 21st, 1939, received a letter that would save her life. It was from her pen pal Margaret Roberts, the future Prime Minister. After the pogroms in November 1938, Edith wrote to Muriel Roberts in Grantham, desperately seeking help to get out of Austria. Muriel, sister of Margaret, told Edith that her father, a local grocer, was keen to help. An active member of the Grantham Rotary Club, Albert Roberts read out the appeal from Edith and asked for help. The club members decided to bring her over to England and supported her with a guinea a week pocket money. Too old for the Kinder Transport scheme, the Grantham Rotary Club helped get Edith a visa to travel to England. About that life-saving visa, Edith wrote to the Roberts, "I thank you very much for sending it. I will never in my whole life forget you." By April 1939, Edith had arrived in Grantham with two presents, handbags for Muriel and 13-year-old Margaret. Their father, also a local preacher, ignored some local voices expressing anti-Semitic views and opened his home to Edith. It was not an entirely happy affair, as Edith found the Roberts family kind but rather cold, so she was moved to another Rotarian family in the town. Later in life, Edith looked back on that letter from Muriel Roberts. If Muriel had said, "I'm sorry, my father says no," I would have stayed in Vienna and they would have killed me. In a similar vein, Frederick Attenborough, president of the Leicester Rotary Club, also won support for looking after Jewish refugee children. He and his wife took in two German Jewish sisters who became part of the Attenborough family for the rest of their lives. The range of support for these children by Rotarians extended from fundraising appeals, talks to raise awareness of their plight, and the provision of safe homes for the refugees. One such talk was given by the Reverend W.W. Simpson to Bristol Rotarians on May 15, 1939. The Western Daily Press reported that Simpson, later a co-founder of the Council of Christians and Jews, said, "No movement was better qualified than Rotary because of its ideals and its constitution to interest itself in the refugee problem." Though the scale of the Rotarian response to Hitler's persecution of its tiny Jewish minority, less than 1% of the German population, is not yet known, there is no doubt that the movement played a significant role in the help of refugees and the Kindertransport children in particular. Mike Levy is the author of the book Get the Children Out, Unsung Heroes of the Kindertransport. He is currently researching British families who took in Kindertransport refugees. If your family or someone you know hosted a Jewish refugee from 1938, contact Mike at mike.levy82@gmail.com. That's mike.levy82@gmail.com.
Rotary crosses borders to honour wartime heroes. On February the 14th, 1943, 23-year-old Flight Lieutenant Billy Kirk took off from RAF Leckenfield en route to Cologne, piloting a Wellington bomber with his crew of five. The bomber was attacked by a Luftwaffe night fighter flown by OFW Hermann Schontier, 2 kilometres south of Meerhout near Antwerp, Belgium. One flight sergeant was killed instantly, 3 other members of the crew managed to bail out and spent the rest of the war at a camp in Poland. However, Billy Kirk and Pilot Officer Mason were unable to bail out as their parachutes had been burned in a fire which extended from the main wing spar to the tail. As the local people watched the planes circled, trying to avoid housing, but both airmen perished in the crash. A German army recovery group arrived to claim the wreckage, but an argument developed with a nearby Luftwaffe unit led by OFW Chantier, who also claimed the wreckage as theirs. Neither of them found the tailplane of the aircraft because a farmer had already hidden it. In 1985, it was recovered and placed on a pedestal as a memorial which carries the names of all 6 members of the crew. The memorial is mistakenly called the wing because that was what locals thought it to be. However, when the error was realised, it was decided to keep the name Wing because it has become so well known. Billy Kirk and Pilot Officer Mason are buried in the Commonwealth War Graves Cemetery in Antwerp. Had he survived, Billy Kirk would have been father-in-law to Wolverhampton Rotarian Richard Green and grandfather to his son Geoffrey and daughter Catherine. On a recent visit to Belgium, the Rotary Club of Tessendello welcomed the family with an excellent example of fellowship and remembrance of an outstanding hero. Every year, on the anniversary of the crash, the local association of Belgian military veterans hold a parade at the wing to pay tribute to the crew and give thanks for all the service personnel who gave their lives in seeking to liberate their country. Richard explained, "Geoffrey, Catherine and I arranged to visit Meerhout to pay our respects, and this was when the local Rotary Club of Tessenderlo, under the leadership of President André Oyem, stepped in to make our visit so memorable. We went to a specially arranged meeting of the club that was also attended by the Rotary Club of Giel to hear a fascinating talk by local historian André van Genetschen. The next day, we met at the town hall where we signed the Golden Book in the presence of the mayor, Nelly Gudens. The book commemorates memorable events in the town. We then went to the Wing, accompanied by the mayor, where a special parade by the Belgian Association of Military Veterans was staged in our honour, followed by the playing of national anthems, short speeches, and the laying of a wreath by Catherine. During the ceremony, the family were introduced to 85-year-old Melanie Aiskins, who witnessed the crash and saw the remains of Billy Kirk and Mason in the wreckage before being told to go away by the Germans. Richard added, it was an emotional visit, made memorable by the fellowship of Rotary across borders. Rotary reaches the stars. It's not often you get a Hollywood celebrity joining your Rotary Club, but that's what happened to the Rotary Club of Ballymena in Northern Ireland. To mark the 80th anniversary of the County Antrim-based club, they conferred an honorary membership on film star Liam Neeson, who grew up in Ballymena and whose family have close links to the Rotary Club. Linda Bell, the club's membership chair, explained, Liam Neeson's family are well known in the town of Ballymena. Indeed, some of the family members are stalwart supporters of our Rotary Club events. As membership chair, I discussed with the family the proposal to confer honorary membership on Liam, who had attended Northern Regional College, the same school as myself. I subsequently contacted his PA in New York, setting out the club's ethos and the various community projects and youth activities in which it engages. Needless to say, I was delighted when the reply came back within 24 hours, stating that Liam humbly accepted our invitation. The Rotary Club of Ballymena is one of 70 clubs in District 1160, receiving its charter on September 27, 1943. Members, former members and friends attended a celebratory dinner in the Adair Arms Hotel in the company of the Mayor of Mid and East Antrim, Alderman Geraldine Mulvaner, and Rotary Ireland District Governor, Kenny Fisher. At the dinner, Linda told the audience that honorary membership was a special award and it was being offered to the Hollywood star in recognition of his outstanding achievements over a long and distinguished career. She told guests, in addition to numerous accolades in the film industry, Liam's commitment to charitable causes, particularly UNICEF, embodies the very essence of Rotary and service above self. Liam has volunteered with UNICEF for over 20 years, and as a goodwill ambassador for the charity, he has visited Mozambique and more recently Jordan to meet children affected by the Syrian crisis. Although unable to join the event, Liam sent a video message from his home in New York. He said, I want to pass on my heartiest congratulations to the Rotary Club of Ballymena on this, your 80th anniversary. 80 years of service to the community is a magnificent achievement. I pay tribute to those founding members who had the courage and vision to establish the club in 1943, right in the middle of the Second World War. I commend your members today who share that same commitment to improve the lives and conditions of people in my great hometown of Ballymena and across the world. I am deeply honoured to accept your invitation to become an honorary member and wish you continued success in the years ahead. Following this message, his honorary certificate and Rotary lapel pin were presented to Liam's two sisters, Elizabeth Connaughton and Bernadette Sexton, who were present on the evening. The honorary certificate, along with a photograph of Liam receiving the certificate, went on display at a Rotary exhibition held in the Braid Arts Centre Town Hall during the first 2 weeks of October. Aquabox helps families rebuild their lives. Aquabox has had one of its busiest years as a humanitarian charity, providing aid to Ukraine, Morocco, Libya, Syria and Turkey. The charity, managed and run by the Rotary Club of Wirksworth in Derbyshire, provides boxes of essential humanitarian aid, together with a special filter to guarantee potable drinking water to people in crisis-hit areas. After last February's massive earthquake, which struck southern and central Turkey, along with northern and western Syria, Aquabox responded to the disaster along with other humanitarian charities by providing aid. They had been helping families on either side of the Syria-Turkey border who are without adequate shelter or safe water supplies and unable to return to their homes. Of greater consequence has been the harsh Balkan winter weather. Teaming up with Water Survival Box, a partner charity which also provides humanitarian aid, Aquabox prepared a large joint consignment of aid which left the depot in early October. The water filters and gold boxes, packed with pieces of aid equipment, were distributed by volunteers to impacted communities in Syria and Turkey before the winter weather took hold. The devastating earthquake, which hit southern Morocco in September, killed many people, destroying homes, villages, and vital infrastructure. A week later, severe flooding in Libya claimed hundreds of lives, as well as destroying essential infrastructure. In the immediate aftermath of disasters like this, there is a high risk of deadly waterborne diseases such as cholera, and the need to provide safe drinking water is critical in order to avoid further loss of life. Since the disasters occurred, Aquabox has been working with partners in the region to set up a secure supply route into the disaster zones. Early in October, a large consignment of filters was sent to Morocco and Libya, together with a substantial shipment of Aquabox gold boxes. Aquabox's partner in this response is International Emergency Team UK, IETUK. The FireAid affiliated charity who they worked with when responding to 2022 floods in southern Pakistan. IETUK has established a team of trusted distribution and delivery partners on the ground in both countries, and they will manage the distribution of our shipments to those most in need. Following a fantastic fundraising effort by Rotary District 1940 in Germany, as well as generous support from supporters across the world, Aquabox has been able to send a further consignment of water filters to Ukraine. The shipment was transported by Aquabox's logistics partner, John Midgley, to the Rotary Water Sanitation and Hygiene Hub in Lviv. From the hub, half of the shipment will be onward shipped to Mykolaiv in southern Ukraine, to provide safe water to communities impacted by the collapse of the dam earlier this year. The remaining part of the consignment was distributed across the country by the WASH team in Lviv to families and communities with the greatest need, in total meeting the water needs of almost 15,000 people. Find out more at aquabox.org.
45 Days, Rowing the Atlantic Ocean, story by George Bicknell. Gareth Morrell is a member of the Tyneside Rotary Club with a decade-long military career, including tours of Northern Ireland and Bosnia. Having overcome his post-traumatic stress disorder thanks to neuro-linguistic psychotherapy, Gareth changed careers to become a psychotherapist, as well as founding the charity Veterans at Ease. To date, Gareth has helped over 400 veterans, serving personnel and their families deal with PTSD and find peace of mind. A year ago, after 45 days, 1 hour and 54 minutes at sea, Gareth Morrell completed the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge as part of Team Emotive, made up of three members of his military mental health charity Veterans at Ease, Chris Harvey, Jason Watkin and Phil Kite. It is regarded as the world's toughest row, a 3,000-mile feat of endurance from San Sebastián in La Gomera in the Canary Islands to Nelson's Dockyard English Harbour on the Caribbean island of Antigua and Barbuda. In completing the epic challenge, Gareth became the first Rotarian to cross the Atlantic Ocean in a rowing boat. After 3.5 years of training and fundraising in order for the challenge to take place, all that lay in front of Gareth was nearly 2 months of battling the elements in one of the world's most foreboding oceans. How did he get on? Gareth takes you through the journey in his own words. Race day, December the 12th, 2022. Walking down to the marina is quite surreal, knowing that once we depart, there is no going back, as literally after 1 mile out at sea, the currents and tides are so strong you cannot physically row back. A few other rowers are also stirring, and like Chris and myself, are silently walking down to the marina one last time, in quiet contemplation of what must be done and what is yet to come. As the clock ticks ever onwards to 12 o'clock, our departure time, I'm sat in the boat in my seat connected by a harness and elasticated leash, looking up at my wife. Despite the couple of thousand people present, I can only see my darling wife. I gesture to her using hand signals that I love her as tears begin to roll down my cheeks. They're tears of happiness, knowing that all I have to do now to see her again is row to Antigua until someone says stop rowing. We row out slowly to much applause and pageantry. Then, before we know it, we're 2 miles out, and that's it, no going back. The game is on. The first week. It's said in briefings that the worst time is the first 7 days. I found this to be most certainly true. There is so much going on that your body and mind are desperately trying not to get overwhelmed. You have to eat, sleep, and go to the loo all in the space of 3 single beds, whilst sharing this space with 3 other men who are not slight in stature. There's the sun to keep away from, the motion of the boat, and of course getting used to each other, how we are in the early hours, as well as how we are before and after a 2-hour shift on the oars. The blisters were dealt with by wrapping them with zinc oxide tape. After a few days, the skin under the tape hardened quite nicely. Stormy weather. The following 7 days from Boxing Day were by far the most taxing and testing for us. The weather started to get worse and quickly. There is a need for a great deal of self-care in conditions like these, and personal admin in dealing with soaking clothes and swollen hands due to the constant wetness. Eating and drinking enough food and fluids becomes laborious, and even talking is something that, if you're not careful, drifts away. So when the boat gets struck by rogue waves that come out of nowhere at night, your mettle is very severely tested. The waves at this time were at their highest at around 25 to 30 feet. Of course, the benefit of rowing hard to get to the top before they break is that you get that massive surge forward as you literally surf down the other side. Watching the speed counter became exhilarating when you hit a new speed record, and disappointing when you thought you'd got a good wave and didn't go as fast as you'd hoped. Raising morale. Now the rains had stopped and the sun had returned, this gave us time to dry our things out and once again get back to normal. Normal for us, anyway. I decided that I had spent far too long eating cold food, so made it my purpose to boil water every day and rehydrate everyone's meals that they'd chosen. The first hot meal I had tasted was wonderful. It was like I'd only tasted food for the first time, and every spoonful was a pure taste sensation. That simple task of heating water to make hot food had a large influence on the morale of the crew. We began making good decisions about the course with quicker changeovers. Well, Jason and I did. Phil was hilariously late, and lots of laughter would happen as he took over from his manservant Chris. We didn't call him five-star Phil for nothing. A rude awakening, Phil's story. Around week 4, Phil and I were happily rowing in sync together and chatting where possible when Phil noticed a small green light off to our rear port side. I'll hand over the story to Phil now. On my second night shift at 2 a.m, I suddenly saw a boat's green light really close and told Gareth, who clocked, that he could see it too. After only 2 oar strokes, we could see both its navigation lights, which meant it was bearing down on us and fast. We had no power due to low light levels for the previous few days, which meant our batteries hadn't fully charged up, so no AIS or navigation lights were on to tell the other boat of our presence. Whilst the boat was bearing down on us, Chris was now awake. He used his headlamp to assemble the radio. Once Gareth got the torch, the radio arrived, but appeared to me not to be working. I gave it to Gareth, and I used the high-power torch to point directly at the boat. After a few long, and I mean really long, seconds, the boat shone its light on us, and at the same time responded to Gareth's calm yet urgent message that they were now aware of us. It then sped, and I mean sped, across our stern from right to left less than 100 feet away. The captain just said, "We wish you luck," and they were gone. On reflection, if we had done nothing, there was a very high likelihood of a significant and catastrophic incident. approaching Antigua. We have been in touch with our loved ones, ensuring they have everything we need when we arrive. 2 days to go, and things are feeling like they're coming to a veritable whirlwind of a conclusion. We see Antigua for the first time at night. The bright lights are a fiery giveaway. We can now also see the lights of other Caribbean islands, and I keep checking the chart plotter to make sure we're still heading for the right island. It makes me wonder what the mariners did long ago when approaching a new island at night. January the 26th, 2023. Challenge completed. As the day breaks, we are in clear sight of Antigua and can see individual houses as we are now only 8 miles or so away. Our skipper is in touch with the race safety team, who is telling us to row closer to the shore and then row parallel to it. Around 11 a.m, the first other human beings we have seen since the race yacht incident arrive in the form of two Antiguan coast guards. They circle us for a few minutes, probably ensuring that we are okay. Then, just before they speed off, they shout, "Welcome to Antigua." Wow, for some reason that was a really emotional moment for me. Finally, we cross in between the two boys, and Ian Crouch from the race safety team lights a flare from where he is at the small fort on a small peninsula that juts out into the bay. We can now stop rowing. We have done it. Emotions well up like a volcano erupting. I lean back and congratulate Chris, who has leaned forward to do the same. I lean forward and give our skipper a hug. He was steering us in manually from around 3 miles out. Then we let the oars go and get out of our foot straps. We are being led in and directed by Atlantic campaign staff and make landfall with a gentle bump. Waiting for us are around 80 cheering, clapping and flag-waving souls. We can finally go forward to hug our expectant loved ones who have flown out to meet and greet us when we land. As you can imagine, there are lots of tears. One last thing. We get led over to a gazebo where waiting for us is a lovely plate of burgers and chips and a nice ice-cold beer. Heaven. Would I do it again? Well, you'll just have to book me in for a talk to find out. Find out more. Gareth, that's G-A-R-R-E-T-H, at veteransatease.org. The evolution of Shelterbox's emergency shelter aid. John Cleverly, Rotary Marketing Officer with Shelterbox, outlines how the charity, founded by Rotarians at the turn of the century, operates in disaster zones. Emergency shelter is at the heart of what Shelterbox does, and we're constantly adapting the support we offer. It's this practical and flexible approach that drives our work and allows us to be there for people after they're caught up in traumatic events. Dome tents. From our first response after the 2001 earthquake in Gujarat, India, we became known for our domed Vango tents, and it's still a strong and spacious shelter to this day. As we responded in different climates with heavy rainfall or winter temperatures, we adapted our tent design, adding extra ventilation, further rain protection, and a silver lining for heat retention and reflection. UN Family Tent. We continued to learn from the people we supported and from other organisations, and found that sometimes a standard approach across organisations can be best when assisting communities. For example, in many projects, Shelterbox works alongside governments and other charities to provide a standard disaster shelter, such as the UN Family Tent. These tents are large and better suited to some of the communities we are working with. We initially started to use the UN Family Tents in Syria in 2013, as they work well where people find that they have to settle for some time. Shelter kits. Depending on people's context, a tent is not always the right shelter solution. When there has been a flood or homes are destroyed in war or extreme weather, there isn't always space for a tent or solid ground to place them on, or in situations where homes are damaged and they need making safe. The next step on our journey started in 2014, when we began providing shelter kits in Paraguay and northern Syria. These disasters were both in urban areas and needed a shelter type that was more flexible. These very practical kits include two heavy-duty tarpaulins, a spade, hammer, saw, nails, and wire. Other materials and solutions. In Burkina Faso, we work with people displaced by conflict. There, we have been adapting shelter structures to suit local customs and situations, providing the Sahelian tent. The design makes use of tarpaulins stretched over a locally sourced wooden frame with large openings to allow good airflow. It's a more durable structure, suited for use by people who have been displaced in the extreme climate of the Sahel region. Also on the African continent, our partners in Nigeria, ACTED, worked with trained carpenters to build shelters more suited to local customs and contexts using heavy-duty tarpaulins and a timber frame. The Bama shelters create a home for up to 5 people, with windows and an internal partition to provide privacy or to allow smaller families to live together. Shelterbox is evolving so that we can find the right solutions that meet the needs of people affected by different disasters in different places. We also understand even more that shelter is the crucial foundation that enables families to recover and rebuild after conflict and disaster. Find out more, shelterbox.org.
The Big Issue. In each edition of Rotary Magazine, expert contributors will be turning the spotlight on some of society's biggest challenges in The Big Issue. Artificial Intelligence, Adapt or Die, story by Alicia Ridout. In the few years since I joined Rotary, we've seen technology advance in ways which could be the subject of Hollywood sci-fi movies. While many still use text messages to get appointment reminders, the world has entered a new phase of its digital evolution, driven by humans in the midst of global climate challenges, wars, mass migrations, and other international events. Artificial intelligence, AI, is all over the press and in the news. AI is in our smartphones and in our smart assistants like Amazon Alexa or Google Nest. AI helps us choose things to buy, influences our decisions, helps doctors to find tumours at an early stage, and also provides cover for criminal activity. Regulation is playing catch-up, and in the meantime, ethical frameworks and guides are being published to try and manage its design, development, and deployment. So, what is artificial intelligence? The Oxford Online, of course, dictionary describes it as the theory and development of computer systems able to perform tasks normally requiring human intelligence, such as visual perception, speech recognition, decision-making, and translation between languages. But for most people, it's like smoke and mirrors, invisible to the eye, whose way of working is unknown and mysterious. AI is part of my doctoral studies, looking at the safe use of this technology with older adults in England, and there are a few salient points helpful to keep in mind. AI is using big data, and the humans designing it employ that data to train it to answer questions or solve problems. The challenges are complex, but include, for example, using data which may not reflect the needs of older people or those from diverse communities. Big data is often taken from the internet for this purpose, so it is hard to be absolutely sure that it's accurate. Lesson 1. Don't assume it's tailored to me. Does it make sense? You may have heard of the ChatGPT, which is a large language model, LLM, AI. It has taken all the words on the internet, and when you ask it a question, it will use that data to create an answer. If it doesn't know the answer, it can create a response which looks completely valid, but is made up. Equally, it might forget things it has learned. ChatGPT is subject to copyright laws, so it does not reference anything it uses, and sometimes it can be wrong. ChatGPT is also useful to create easy-to-understand text, which may help with patient information, for example. It is a generative form of AI, which continually learns from its own activities. Lesson 2. Use AI, but fact-check it. Be vigilant and be open about using an LLM. Similarly, the latest AI technology is using 3-second clips of human voices to create passable mimics of individuals. Unfortunately, scammers are diverting this, but it could help people using communication aids to rediscover their own voices and sense of self-identity, like Rob Burrows, the rugby player who has motor neuron disease. Lesson 3. Usual rules apply to everything where scammers and phishing are concerned. Stay safe online. There are multiple definitions and examples, podcasts and guides available, in particular on BBC Sounds, which provide thought-provoking, accessible information to help us manage this new technology. It is embedded in many of our favourite smartphone apps and tablet devices, so it's no longer a future state we can avoid. We need to learn more about AI and understand the risks and benefits. That way, we can decide what we feel about it and how it might help us. For example, stay safe and independent at home as we age. Lesson 4. Keep learning. Ask questions. Use verified, trusted sources of support. What does it mean for us as Rotarians? We are people of action and put service above self. We are facing a range of recruitment challenges and an aging membership here and internationally. I was visiting Saskatoon in Saskatchewan, Canada in 2023 and made contact with Rotarians to find out more about their club. They are facing the same challenges we are. They recognise the opportunities technology is now presenting Rotarians internationally, and I joined their face-to-face meeting with an online presentation from Rotaract members in Morocco. Members are already experimenting with ChatGPT to create marketing materials. AI is helping us communicate across the world and locally via Facebook and other social media platforms. New Rotarians are likely to expect that we are a digitally enabled and a smart community. We are at a crossroads and can avoid the smart world or embrace it in an educated fashion where we still put human interaction, well-being and connectivity front and centre. Adapt or die, as a worldwide community, we have the opportunity to choose a new path. Alicia Ridout. Alicia is an occupational therapist, director of a digital co-design company, a clinical safety officer and doctoral student looking at digital clinical safety and the use of AI with older adults already using this complex technology. She is presidential nominee for Airborough Rotary Club near Leeds. The big issue. If you have a topical issue which you are an expert in and would like to share in future big issue platforms, then email editor@rotarygbi.org.
One voice. North Star, 60,000 members by 2028. Robert Morris, Chair of the Board for Rotary GB and I. Why North Star? Our great organisation has to adapt now to keep up with the vast changes happening in wider society. While becoming recognised as a regional pilot by Rotary International has been a boost, our new regional governance arrangements were a homegrown initiative. Our strategic regional board can consider and implement long-term plans, much as you'll find in big business. We finally have a 5-year strategic plan, and through continuity, the board intend to see that through. After all, it's not a coincidence that North Star is a 5-year vision. Projects are considered through small working groups that include specific skills available in the wider membership. Membership growth and experience sees a positive experience starting with that initial inquiry and continuing by fulfilling their desire to give something back to society through Rotary. The communications workstream is streamlining many aspects of online information, administration and messaging for members and the general public. Learning and development is reviewing the whole facilitated learning programme. Also, by locally supplementing the materials on the RI Learning Centre, we have an opportunity to get accreditation and be recognised for the skills we can offer potential future leaders in business as much as within Rotary. Organisational effectiveness encompasses cluster development, financial stability through different approaches as much as cost efficiency, and the complex legal plan for incorporated status. Specialist advisors have a greater GB&I regional focus and work collaboratively with the Rotary Great Britain and Ireland Support Centre at Ulster. Becoming one of two regional pilot areas also brought the potential for Rotary International investment, supporting their regional adaptability pilots. Getting RI funding was a successful yet bumpy ride, much as with any business investment. Detailed tasks are linked to the action plan and our workstream outputs, with key performance indicators to monitor progress. North Star grew from needing a sound funding case, yet it is more a vision to truly grow our membership to 60,000 by 2028. Through an expansion of business as usual, including new routes to membership, and projects to modernise the organisation and make it more appealing to modern society. We're now into the operational phase of implementing the North Star whole and sharing the vision with district teams and your clubs. This is complementary to, not instead of, the ongoing work of the specialist advisor teams, support centre, and very much the districts. It is now for each of you to help translate the ambitious vision into a successful reality. Born in 1924, 100 years of Watford Rotary. In February, Watford Rotary will be celebrating 100 years of service to the community in Hertfordshire. This was a time which marked a dramatic rise in the number of Rotary clubs in Great Britain and Ireland in the wake of the First World War. 1920s. In its first 25 years, Watford Rotary sponsored a new club in St Albans, endowed a ward in the Peace Memorial Hospital, ran a car service for the blind, and started an international friendship club for refugees following World War II. Michael Hammond is this year's club president and Watford Rotary's longest-serving member. He said, "I first joined a charitable organisation after serving my national service in Egypt, and at 20, in order to maintain the camaraderie of the RAF, I joined Round Table, where unhappily at 40 we had to resign to join a similar group called Rotary International. In Round Table, which incidentally was founded by a Watford Rotarian, we rushed around digging gardens, painting houses and heading up the Watford Carnival dressed like pirates. Rotary was and is more forward-looking and measured in its approach to problems across the world, being involved in so many projects to do with education, earthquakes, floods, hardship, medical projects, plagues and tsunamis. I was immediately involved and became excited by all the different avenues and means of raising funds for Watford and South West Hertfordshire, as well as for the international projects. An example of Watford Rotary's involvement in Europe followed World War II, when the club helped thousands of misplaced people who found themselves on the wrong side of the borders between the Western Allies and communist countries. Architect and Rotarian Henry Colbeck worked hard to repatriate people back to their homelands. Today," explained Michael Hammond, "Watford Rotary features a mixture of talents and professions." He added, "During my 48 years of membership, I have met and worked with some very clever people and enjoyed many wonderful visits abroad and in the UK. There, our universal connections are instant and effective in developing a network of like-minded individuals who work together to tackle local, national and international needs through projects that cross borders, as well as work closely in our own community here in Watford and South West Hertfordshire. For example, sponsoring local schools to develop creativity together with specific charitable fundraising such as the Shelter Box Appeal. In turning the clock back over the past century, the Watford Rotary president reflected on the club's support for the Jarrow Marches in the 1920s and its campaigning for a Peace Memorial Hospital in the 1930s, which is now a hospice. 1940s. In the 1940s, despite wartime restrictions, the Rotary Club was able to give substantial post-war donations, for example to the Help Holland Appeal. This was an appeal which I recall being spoken of years later by individuals who had benefited from the food drops which Rotary had facilitated," added Michael. "Since its inception, Watford Rotary has supported its local hospital, and in the 1940s, Ward C became the Rotary Club of Watford Ward. In response to the recovery of Europe after the war, the club organised equipment and clothing to be sent to refugee camps in Germany and Czechoslovakia, now known as the Czech Republic and Slovakia. 1950s. By 1955, Watford Rotary had a membership 67 strong, which started up a Meals on Wheels project, an international languages club, and supported holidays to Worthing for the underprivileged. 1960s. During the 1960s, the club provided an ambulance for the St John's Ambulance and funded a technical training award alongside other donations. 1970s. And in the 1970s, Watford Rotary was very active socially, organising one of the highlights of the year, the Beggar's Ball at Watford Town Hall, which brought in large donations from industry and individuals. 1980s. Michael Hammond said that in the 1980s he and other Rotarians were active with Driving for the Blind and helping rebuild the Blind Centre, as well as supporting talking books for the blind. 2000s. Looking abroad, the club actively fundraised for Nepal when the Himalayan country suffered a massive earthquake and provided help for the Philippines following the tsunami. More recently, the club has been supporting vulnerable people in the Watford area affected by the cost of living crisis. There are many ways we have approached fundraising, but I'm pleased to report the camaraderie I found when I first joined remains in the way we work together, as does the need in the modern world for organisations such as Rotary to give to causes," added Michael. "The rather small Rotary wheel badge we wear with much pride is an instant introduction to millions of like-minded people worldwide, and I feel privileged to be part of an organisation that has changed and evolved, and as we enter the Watford Club's 100th year, yet still has an opportunity to continue to act to support and impact the world and local community." one voice. Barry Rassin, Rotary Foundation Trustee Chair. Make the foundation yours. The new year ushers in promise and hope, a time to resolve to do things differently. We can do more than just hope for the best. We can take steps, big and small, to make changes in every aspect of our lives, including Rotary. Here's a New Year's resolution to consider. Remember that the Rotary Foundation belongs to you. The Foundation is a global force doing our good work in the world. Just like anything that belongs to you, it requires care and attention. How can we do this? First, get to know your Foundation better this year. Did you know that in 2023, the Foundation achieved a maximum 4-star rating from Charity Navigator for the 15th consecutive year? This places your Foundation among the world's top charities. Why do we consistently receive this honour? It's because we are financially strong, have a broad reach, and are highly effective with the gifts you give. 91% of funds are allocated to programme awards and operations. Another way to engage with your Foundation is to support it through a gift every year. We've set an ambitious fundraising goal of $500 million this year, and I'm confident that with your support we will achieve it. This year, I'm counting on those Rotarians and Rotaractors who have not yet contributed to make their first gift. Because the Rotary Foundation is an excellent steward, you can be confident that your gift will make a difference, whether it's in polio eradication, literacy initiatives, peace education, or any other area in which we excel. In 2024, resolve to share the Foundation with others. The Foundation is too great to keep to ourselves. Spread the word during your fundraisers and events. Let the public know that the Rotary Foundation plays a significant role in everything we do, including in our many partnerships. Anyone can support the Foundation, even people who are not in Rotary. Lastly, this year, take action. Your Foundation is waiting for you to roll up your sleeves and make use of its resources to make the world a better place. Seek out global or district grant projects. Consider partnering with a Rotaract Club in 2024 to support a grant or collaborate on one. Team up with Rotary and Rotaract Clubs in your area to plan your biggest million-dollar dinner fundraiser or End Polio Now event. Whatever you decide to do in 2024, commit to keeping our Foundation in your plans. I can't wait to hear about all the great things we will accomplish this year. Find out more. RotaryGBI.org/foundation. An act of kindness. Thousands of people across London sleeping rough now have essential gear for keeping warm thanks to Françoise Cole's project Kind Winter. Story by George Bicknell. Françoise Cole, a member of the London Rotary Club, has been leading a team of dedicated volunteers as part of the Kind Winter project to provide immediate protective gear to the homeless population of the capital. Using negotiating skills gained from holding multiple managerial positions in the health and housing industries, Françoise works with multiple non-government organisations, such as the Salvation Army and local churches, bringing them on board to distribute the essential provisions provided by Kind Winter. Kind Winter is a charitable project drawing on the team's experience of mountaineering, outdoor industry, housing, health, homelessness and scaling to provide essential equipment to those sleeping rough. It is completely run by volunteers with no overheads, reliant on individuals and companies donating to Kind Winter, with 100% of donations going to the homeless. Françoise, originally from South Pacific Island of New Caledonia, has lived in London for over 40 years, dedicating much of that time engaged in a variety of charity work. She has been particularly struck by the plight of homeless people where she lives. She said, "I live in Chelsea, one of the most expensive parts of London and the world. I get off the tube and see people on the pavement. I just can't believe we have a society that has allowed that." Françoise is also an experienced mountaineer, being the first ever woman to hold the role of Honorary Secretary of the Alpine Club. It's some of these experiences which have given Françoise an understanding for the plight of those sleeping on the streets. She explained, "I know what it is like to sleep outside, and I know the kind of suffering that it can engender. It's not just the possibility of getting pneumonia, it's also the important aspect of sleep deprivation, because when you're cold you can't sleep, it physically hurts. I know exactly what's happening because I've done it, but even when I do it, it's not really comparable because I know I've got a warm bed in a few days and I have the best kit possible. They don't." She remembers a moment in February 2020 where she got to witness the grim reality of being homeless. "It was one February, it was minus 10 degrees C in London. We had young men coming to the Methodist church where I was volunteering who were homeless and their skin was raw from the cold. Our cupboards were bare, so I had nothing to give them, and it was then I realised that there must be a way to provide the goods we need, specifically for the homeless. Sleeping bags are like gold on the streets. Very few are donated to charities, as members of the public rarely have spare ones compared to coats and blankets. After having no luck with reaching out to outdoor brands for assistance, Françoise took matters into her own hands with the help of a previous Rotary Club, the Rotary Club of Mayfair. I remember saying, let's just fundraise and buy in large numbers, and my goal at the time was just to fill the cupboards of my local homelessness day centre. We fundraised so well that we got more than for just one centre, so we gave them out to other homeless centres, and it just grew from there. The growth of this project eventually led to Françoise and her team reaching a deal with Mountain Warehouse, who donated sleeping bags as well as warehouse space and transport for the ones Kind Winter buys. Kind Winter now has a van supplied by Mountain Warehouse, which was recently used to distribute over 1,000 sleeping bags across London. Several important fundraising events, sleeping bags delivered, and a move to a new Rotary Club, Rotary Club of London later, Françoise's original fundraising project is going strong as Kind Winter. Kind Winter maintains a strong Rotary connection even as it grows and has become its own project outside the organisation. The trustees of the new entity are all Rotarians. Michael Carras is a trustee of the Rotary Club of Westminster International Trust Fund, a registered charity that collects Kind Winter's funds. Gordon Moulds is the ex-CEO of Kids Out. It's the continued collaboration between Rotarians who have a passion for helping the homeless that Françoise is aiming to encourage in order to increase the scale of projects like Kind Winter. One example of such collaboration, thanks to a letter written in the Rotary magazine this summer, is the cooperation with Rucksacks for Homeless in Halifax, created and run by Hazel Brindle. Kind Winter donated immediately 100 sleeping bags to the project and introduced Mountain Warehouse to the project. Françoise added, "It is very much a two-way stream. Hazel has some very good ideas to help the homeless, which one day we might implement on a wider scale. We have been able to bring her some other ways of doing business. I would absolutely love to have a way to connect Rotary further in the UK regarding homelessness, because there's so much more we could do if we helped each other and shared ideas." Find out more. FrancoiseCoole@yahoo.co.uk. That's FrancoiseCoole@yahoo.co.uk. Kindwinter.com.
Rotary Big Interview. Joan's West End Dream. Story by Dave King. Rotarian Joan Greening has written for television, and many of her stage shows have been performed around the world, including at the Edinburgh Festival. But in a first for the talented playwright, she has achieved a lifetime dream by having a show staged on London's West End this February. The bright lights of the West End beckon for Rotarian Joan Greening, who has achieved a life's dream by having a show appear at London's West End. Joan, who has been a Rotarian for 22 years, with the Rotary Club of Elthorne Hillingdon in northwest London, is a published playwright who has been working in theatres all her adult life. At the Edinburgh Fringe in 2022, Joan met composers Joel Goodman and Jan Osborne, who had written the musical Alan Turing, a musical biography. In need of an extra edge to the production, they asked Joan to write the script, and they took the new version back to Edinburgh in August 2023. There, the show received 4 5-star reviews and was nominated for a prestigious Off West End Award. She explained, "This musical is a journey through the extraordinary life of Alan Turing. Alan was a genius whose brilliant code-breaking brain saved approximately 14 million lives in World War II. It takes us on a journey through the loss of his closest friend, his romance with a fellow worker, the moment he realizes how to beat the Germans, and the growing awareness of his homosexuality. His treatment after the war was truly appalling, and this brilliant, funny man was left in despair." Joan admitted her knowledge of Alan Turing was limited to seeing Benedict Cumberbatch play him in the film The Imitation Game, so she spent a lot of time reading up about the mathematical genius. "For the musical, I haven't written him as Benedict Cumberbatch played him. People say he was a funny man who had lots of friends, but someone who also liked to be on his own. You might describe him as an eccentric professor." After success at the Edinburgh Festival, Joel and Jan, who also produced the show, then asked Joan if she could lengthen the musical by 30 minutes. Now the show will be opening at Wonderville Haymarket on February the 27th until March the 3rd. It stars Joe Bishop as Alan Turing and Zara Cook, and is directed by Jane Bowen Miles. This is the latest accolade for Joan, whose husband John is also a Rotarian at Elthorn Hillingdon. She's previously written extensively for television and theatre, creating the ITV situation comedies The Cabbage Patch and Troubles and Strife. Writing a script for a musical was a totally new departure for Joan, who regularly takes period dramas to the Edinburgh Festival and on tour around the country. She's now working on another musical with Joel and Jan about Nellie Bly, an American journalist who made her name for a record-breaking trip around the world in 72 days to emulate Jules Verne's fictional character Phileas Fogg. That is likely to be performed at the Edinburgh Festival this year. "It is all very different for me," said Joan. "It's quite challenging because it means working as a team, which I'm not used to doing. That has been a learning experience. It's fair to say, too, that I am no longer young, but it's been energising to work with other people, and that's really good for me. I'm enjoying it." In a 40-year career, Joan has written around 50 plays, including comedies, tracing the lives of many historical characters. I would think a lot of them have gone out of print or are old-fashioned. In fact, I wrote a play in the 1980s called Continental Quilts. Well, no one calls them that anymore, do they? Joan draws her inspiration from reading, and she's also very fond of art. "I don't think I'll ever have nothing to write about. I've got lots of ideas in my head. I'm writing a one-man show for a young actor at the moment. He's very young and talented, and I thought that for his character, he needs to be somebody quite nasty. So I've written the play about a painter, and he is nasty." As for the accolades of her play, appearing in London's West End, Joan is fairly laid back about it publicly, though privately one suspects that she is bursting with pride. "I've never been overly ambitious," she admitted. "I've been very happy just doing what I do. I've had a lot of plays published, I have a steady income from that, and I've been very happy with that. Both Joel and Jan are much younger than I am, and I'm just so pleased that they're getting what they want. For me, it's absolutely marvellous, and I'm thrilled a bit, but I'm more thrilled for them." Joan acknowledges that Rotary plays an important part in her life. She's been the driving force behind an Interact club at Northwood School, which is so popular there's a waiting list. She has also been working with other Rotarians on a reading project with students at the Middlesex School. Asked about her favourite play of all time, Joan replies, "Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream." Why? "Because I think it's the best plotted of Shakespeare's plays, and a lot of the language is wonderful. It also has my favourite line from Shakespeare, which could not be more apt at this time. It's when Puck says, 'Lord, what fools these mortals be.' You look around the world today and think, why can't people just live in peace? We're given a wonderful world to live in, and for some reason, we can't live in peace, can we? It's so very sad." For tickets, feverup.com/m/132139.
The funny side of fellowship. West Country Rotarian and comedian Tank Sherman has worked his way into a prestigious group of entertainers who share a passion for voluntary work. Story by George Bicknell. In an historic pub in King's Cross, London, called The Water Rats, known for hosting musical acts such as Bob Dylan and Oasis, you'll find a group of charitable comedians, musicians and TV personalities who make up the Grand Order of Water Rats, one of the UK's most high-profile charities. Starting in 1889, the Grand Order of Water Rats uses the talent and caregiving nature of its members to organise events that raise money for those less fortunate, mainly within the entertainment industry. Previous members include comedy legends such as Charlie Chaplin and Tommy Cooper, with King Charles, an honorary Rotarian, being a known supporter of the group. Among the esteemed entertainers in the pub's lodge room where the group meets, now sits a recent addition to this esteemed gathering, comedian and Rotarian Graham Lovegrove, better known by his stage name Tank Sherman. A dedicated member of the Liscard and Lou Rotary Club in Cornwall, Graham is relishing the opportunity to be part of this charitable group of which several of his comedy heroes are previous and current members. He said, "When you walk into the actual lodge room, there's photos everywhere and you can just feel their presence. It's an absolute honour to be in there. You do look at some of those people and think, why me? but it's all the same goal of working together to benefit people that can't afford much. What they do is amazing, and if I can be a little part of it, that's great. It's hard to believe that Graham's decades-long Tank Sherman character was never meant to last more than one performance at a holiday park talent show in Weymouth nearly 30 years ago. Graham, 65, remembers, "I decided to go into the main entertainment hall as they were having the auditions for a talent contest. I was sat at the back, and I must admit I'd had a bit to drink, but I found it hilarious. One of the team members came up to me, asked what I do, asked what caravan I was in, and then said, 'Well, you can't come in here and laugh at people, so you're on third tonight.' A hurried trip with his wife to the costume shop later, and soon he was on stage with a soldier's helmet, sequined shirt, and a dustbin hung around his torso. This look also brought about the first time he was introduced with his now iconic name, almost. Graham recalls, 'I got myself together and dressed up as a stupid soldier. As I came on stage, the girl said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we've got a Sherman tank coming on stage." And I said, "No, no, no, tell them my name is Tank Sherman." After winning the talent contest and surprising friends and family when his picture was published in the local paper, a friend of Graham's decided to put him forward for another competition. Graham continues, "I won that, and there was an agent in the crowd who came up to me and said, 'Here's my card, would you like to work?' That was it, really." What followed was an eventful career in comedy, which saw Graham bringing joy to people up and down the country, whether it was from the stages of clubhouses or theatres to primetime television. Despite his busy schedule, Graham has always had a place in his heart for Rotary since he joined the organisation back in the mid-2000s. He still vividly remembers the moment he was officially invited into the organisation by his friend John O'Driscoll after a performance at the Babbacombe Theatre in Torquay. He recalls, "I went out and got a big round of applause. Nobody had left, and John O'Driscoll was there, who came up on stage, told them all about me, and then presented me with my honorary membership. It was a fabulous night. I think my eyes teared up a little bit. Being a part of Rotary is special, and I don't think people realise just how much Rotary does. Whether it's with his Rotary Club, with the Grand Order of Water Rats, or if he's putting on a charity performance to benefit a local organisation, Graham has always prioritised giving back through his comedy. I think because the world is in such a state, and with everything on TV now, there's not much good news. We've never had bad news like this before, and it's my job to take people into a fantasy world of laughter. I've always said to the audience that if we could bottle laughter, people would come off antidepressants. If we could have a swig of laughter in the morning, the world would be a better place."
Hello. My name is Jeff Mackey, and this is Oddly Enough. I'd like to talk about acting our age in Rotary. As a young working Rotarian, 58 and a half as my kids tell me, perhaps going on 34 or 14 given the opportunity, or perhaps 79, I feel sometimes, I have been told for my whole working life to introduce others to our association. In our Rotary, in our Rotary lifetime, we have allowed our average age to rise, much like my cholesterol. Now, don't get me wrong, age, too much of it or the lack of it, doesn't make us good or bad Rotarians. But the challenge for so many of us is that we can't do today what we did when we joined 20 years ago. What's the secret to a smoking hot body for a Rotarian? Cremation. One thing we can be sure of in life, and I don't mean birth, death, and taxes, thank you, Mark Twain, is that time gently, continually moves onwards. What goes up and never comes down? My age and waistline. We're all getting older, some of us a little shorter, we're getting a bit wider. Your skin will lose its fight with gravity. We don't have to like it, but at least we can laugh about it before we put our back out completely. We all have something to give in our association, in Rotary, a sharing of ourselves, our networks, professional and personal abilities. But this changes at different life stages. We need to reflect that in our Rotary activities, our service, and the good times that we have enjoyed, We need to reflect, learn, before we forget what those are or were. In December, some senior members in my club worry they can no longer do Santa. Walking for miles and hours in the dark and ice, bringing joy to our communities and our children. Let's be honest, the fridge and getting to it is a challenge some days for me. Some Rotarians and some clubs have got others to support their sleigh, to do a night. And this spreads the Rotary joy, it spreads our fellowship, it spreads our communities. We should never be afraid to try things, be the best we can be, professionally, personally, at any life stage. Now I'm older, everything's finally started to click. Knees, back, neck. Our association is aging, declining, but still doing some incredible, fabulous work, often based on our predecessor's legacy. We may bring in new like-minded members. Maybe it's time to introduce others with their own different views. A diversity of view, even. Perhaps this could permeate as change, if we can just remember what we were talking about in the first place. New members bring all sorts of new ideas, thoughts, opportunities for service, sociality. My club actually came out and did a samba night recently. And no, I didn't, before you ask. I hear the words of my father. Is there no tune in that music? You're not going out dressed like that. Critical feedback. Wisdom. We have flourished as Rotarians, growing, some of us growing older, greyer, but we still have plenty to give, including letting and supporting others flourish before we finish. Just because it didn't work doesn't mean it won't work now, if we can recall what didn't work when, obviously. What we have inherited, what we leave, is ours to choose. But let's understand. We can all bring lots of Rotary, whatever our maturity, which, as we're all aware, is very different from age, of course. We're not getting old, we're becoming a classic vintage. Like a fine wine, I get more complex with age and vinegar. P.S. Old age is a heck of a lot better than the alternative. My name is Jeff Mackey. I'm a proud member of the Audley Rotary Club, District 1210, just off Junction 16 of the M6. And I'm currently the president in our 60th year of community, local, international service.
So that's it for the winter issue of Rotary Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and do let me know what you think of the audio edition. I always enjoy receiving your correspondence, so you can email me at editor@rotarygbi.org. Rotary Magazine has been presented by editor Dave King and a team of professional narrators. All items in this audio edition are copyright and owned by Rotary International, Great Britain and Ireland. A downloadable edition of this audio magazine for visually impaired members can be requested. The audio magazine is also available to download or stream by visiting the Rotary in Great Britain and Ireland website at rotarygbi.org/magazine. I hope you can join us for the spring issue, which will be available in April. Now, if you watched the BBC TV programme MasterChef just before Christmas, you will have seen Tom Hamblett win the title. Well, Tom is a former winner of the Rotary Young Chef competition, and I'm hoping to have a chat with him shortly for a fascinating feature in the spring issue. So, thanks for listening, and I look forward to you joining us next time.